For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Nice to see you. I see a lot of people already away on vacation or scared away by the rain, but it's good to see all of you are out and about. Let me just start right away by thanking Harry Robbins for, as true to his word, dedicating the donuts. Donuts you asked for and donuts you got. Thank you, Harry, honoring and sponsoring tonight's class in honor of his lovely wife, Jean. Thank you very much. Great to have you both here. Thank you very much. Housekeeping. This was left here last week. If this belongs to you, if you recognize it. One other housekeeping announcement. Next week we will not have a class on Monday the 29th for our, as most people assume, are off from work. So we will not have a class next. We'll have the following class. Will be Monday, January 5th will be our next class that we will have. Tonight's class is on free will. Let me just get two jokes out of the way so we can focus. So this needs to be said just so we can move on. I know it's all in your minds. Number one, for all of you who completely failed the free will test of the donuts in the back, this was a test and you all failed miserably. Really? Yeah, okay, some of you passed. Okay, some of you passed. Okay, but I know it's pretty hard to have a class on free will with those donuts sitting back there. That's joke number one. Joke number two, all of those of you, for those of you who are married men out there, you can leave. This class is not for you. Okay, did I get those out of the way? Are we done? We can focus now? Okay, good. So now that that's out of the way, we can focus on what's... are there any other classic free will jokes that I need to make that we can... we're good? Okay. Okay, let's begin. Okay, I like to start, as I have done a lot in the past, with a thought-provoking question. I don't know if it'll be called provocative, but a thought-provoking question. This is one of my favorite questions. This is asked often at like youth group retreats where they want to engage the kids in certain discussions. So the question goes as follows. If you were to take two Jews, completely vastly different experiences, and let's assume we were to create a spectrum from 1 to 100, 100 being the absolute prime Jew in all religious observances and character traits, just the best, and one being the opposite of the best from a Jewish perspective. And that's our spectrum that we create. And we have two Jews. And we're going to create the question as, who is the better Jew? The Jew who is born into a family in the heart of, Borough Park or Atlanta, Georgia, whichever, raised, you know, they're like sort of synonymous, you can interchange them, it's all the same, raised in an observant home, in an observant community, sent to observant schools. He's given a beautiful Jewish education. He's brought up with everything that a Jew could want, so that when he hits, or when he comes of age, let's call it 18, he's starting from 75. That's what life gave him. Given his background, the knowledge, his education, his parents, his community, he's at a 75. Except when he hits that magical age of 18, he's uninspired. And he doesn't really take to it and grow. And he slips in his observance that he was brought up with. And he ends up at, let's say, when he's 25, he's a 70. He's still doing a lot of things, and he certainly knows a lot of Torah. But we would now put him on the scale, in this made-up scale that I created, he put him at a 70. That's Jew number one. And Jew number two was raised in the middle of Arkansas, and there's not a shul anywhere near where he lives. There's not even a religious Jew anywhere where he lives. And he knows almost nothing but that his family is Jewish. And when he turns 18, given the low level of Jewish knowledge that he was given, his education, he doesn't have parents who will keep anything, he doesn't have a school system, a community, we would put him on our scale because he's a believing Jew, whatever he knows, we'd start him off at a 20 or 25. And when he hits 18, he's struck with this curiosity about his religion and he begins to learn and to study and to take on a few things here or there, but he's in the middle of nowhere. And when he hits 25, he's taken the 20 that he began and he's raised himself to a 25. And now we have this magical question. How do we view these two Jews? We have the first Jew, who at the end of the day is on a 75. In terms of his knowledge, in terms of his observance, in terms of the amount of Torah that he knows, he's pretty high up on the scale, except that he dropped from the 80 that he started to the 75 that he's at now. Versus the other Jew who's at a 25, way below this other Jew in terms of his knowledge, in terms of his observance, in terms of everything, except he's raised himself from the 20 he was given to the 25 that he is. And now we look at the two Jews, one's a 25 and one's a 75. And how are these two Jews viewed? Who is the better, so to speak? That's why these questions are good, because there's no real answer to these questions. But that's why they're fun as just thought-provoking, provocative questions. Who's the better Jew? The one who's at a 75 with his observance, his knowledge, everything he's got, but who dropped, or the 25, which is so far below what we want from the Jew, but he's raised himself? Great question, right? You ever heard this question before? It's like great Shabbos table discussion. You could discuss it forever because of the different aspects to it. But that's a thought-provoking question for the day to begin our discussion. This will frame our discussion, and if I forget to get back to it, remind me at the end just to make sure to answer this question. So tonight's class on free will, the opposite of free will, some of you philosophers out there maybe took some classes in college, is determinism. Determinism is the idea that if you look it up, actually, there are like lots of different aspects of determinism and deterministic thought, but the essence of it is the lives that we live are basically scripted. We are forced into the choices that we make because of circumstances of what happened to us yesterday, which happened to us because of what happened to us the day before that, which happened to us because of what happened before the day before that. And in essence, we are all find ourselves in circumstances in which it looks like we're making decisions, but we're really not making choices. And that the choices that we make can all be explained based on circumstances that have already happened to us that are pushing us, dictating a certain behavior that we have. I first came across this without that word being used, but when I was in Neri Yisrael, I went to college in UMBC, University of Maryland in Baltimore County, and I was a psychology major, and so you have to choose from a number of different classes, and so one of the classes was motivational psychology. So I was super excited to sign up for that class because I wanted to learn all about, I was a very inspired yeshiva boy at the time. I'll get the secular perspective on how do you motivate somebody? How do you get somebody to change, to move, to do things? So motivational psychology. And on the first day of the class, and I remember this so clearly, a professor gets up and describes that the entire course is going to be based on a series of studies that had been done on a bunch of rats. And they had studied the rats to determine what motivates the rat's behavior in terms of punishment and reward and what if you do this and a whole series of studies. And over again, he kept on repeating how we were going to therefore learn what motivates man based on the principles that we can derive from what motivates the rats. And it's like a clear, just a scientific, like this is how it works. Like if I can prove that if I do this to the rats, they'll behave this way, then that's what would happen to mankind as well. And I remember raising my hand, I was like in yeshiva, I'm studying like all day long, and I take out an hour or two, twice a week to go to class. Like, and I was like, don't people have the ability to choose? Like you could do something to a human like 10 times in a row, but the 11th time, he has the ability to change. He can decide, even though he's behaved the same way 10 times in a row, and the rat might continue that, but how do you like connect these two? And I remember him saying, in this classroom, there is no free will. I said, what? No, there's this entire course is built on the premise that there is no free will, as you are asking me about. Like that's not part of the equation. So I remember writing in my notebook, like, oh, this class is heresy. I'm going to have to sit through this and figure out, like, what? This is such a ridiculous premise. How could it be? But there are those out there, a lot of people out there, indeed, who believe that what we're going to learn about tonight doesn't exist. So we are starting from, well, I will spend a minute or two proving that it, not proving, but showing how Torah believes that it does, but that it is not just that it exists, but it is that the it is at the core, fundamental essence of what we are as human beings and as Jews, is understanding this concept of free will, and therefore it's important to understand where it is and where it's not, because it can be confusing if we misplace where this concept is. But this is the fundamental tenet of Judaism that says the choices and decisions you make are not a consequence of the life that you've lived until now. It's not predetermined. It is up to you. And the you will become who the you are based on those choices that you make, and that you and you alone make those choices. Now, that's a broad statement. And all of you probably have questions in your mind, which you should, because we're going to see, we're going to have to define where these, where this point is. What is this concept of free will? But it is fundamental. To begin with, let me just bring you a couple of, just to start. If you open up your sheets, so I photocopied a couple pages. They go in order, but they're not, I don't have the whole thing. It's like a 26 or 30 page packet, and I just cut out a couple pages for you. If you look at page 3, so I'm going to go based on the numbers on the bottom, even though it's not like the third page, but that's the way, just so everybody should be clear what I'm talking about. On the bottom of page 3, source number 1 is the pasuk from Devarim, the end of the Chumash. This is Moshe giving us his final speeches, and this is one of his most beautiful and passionate speeches that he gives. These series of 2 verses, he writes, "See, I set before you today, Hachayim v'es hatov. I gave you life, and I've set before you goodness, v'es hamavas v'es hara, and I set before you evil and death." Those are the choices that sit before you. Life and good on the one side, and evil and death on the other. And I command you today to love Hashem your God, and to walk in His ways, and to keep His commandments, decrees, and His laws. This day, second paragraph, I call heaven and earth as witnesses against you that I have set before you life and death. Shamayim v'aret, they will always be here, and they are my witnesses that I have given you the choice. Uvacharta v'chayim. Choose life. So that you and your children may live. That phrase, uvacharta b'chayim, choose life. I've set before you that which is good and that which is evil, that which is life and that which is death. But I can't do more than that, other than set it before you, Moshe says, and then implore you to choose wisely. It's literally parenting 101. As parents, you can try everything, but at the end of the day, all I can do is lay it out before you, and I can label it as best I can. This is what's good for you, and this is bad. This will give you life, and this will take it away. But at the end of the day, we know we can't do more than that. Because just as we did, we made our own choices. None of us would say, my parents put me on, and they gave us our past, but we make our decisions, and we become who we want. So Moshe, our teacher, our father, says, "Uvacharta b'chayim, please, I implore you, choose life. But it's going to be your choice. And if you don't choose that way, that's also your choice. But I implore you to please choose life." Now, this concept of choosing is not unique to human beings. Animals make choices as well. Animals can make choices as to what they want to eat, whether or not, where they're going to sleep. There are lots of choices that take place. So when we talk about this idea of choosing, the most important point that we need to really establish is, where does this concept apply? To what does it mean that I have a choice when I choose either Cheerios or cornflakes in the morning? So I'm making a choice. I have to choose if I was going to wear a blue tie or a red tie. And I have to make that choice every day. So is that an expression of my free will when I make that choice? So the issue is as follows, and I underline your outline, which is just a basic outline. Free will applies, I put it in a task because this is the most important point. There's one thing to come out of tonight with, it's this following statement. Free will applies only in the area of morality. That's where we talk about free will. There are lots of mechanical choices that we have to make. I have to make a choice of what color socks I'm going to wear. I'm going to have to make a choice if I'm going to wear long sleeves or short sleeves. If I'm going to take a coat, if I'm not going to take a coat. Lots and lots and lots of choices. None of those are at all relevant to the concept of free will. Free will is when you have to make a choice between that which is right and that which is wrong, between that which is moral and that which is immoral, between that which expresses your higher self and that which is your lower animalistic element of who we are. Because we are very much like the animal kingdom. From a physical perspective, very, very similar. We need to eat, we need to sleep, procreate, we set up communities, and then we die. Pretty similar. Except in between that being born and dying, we have a soul which yearns for perfection, which yearns for growth, which yearns for becoming morally superior creatures. And that concept is where free will applies. For those of you who went through a couple years ago already, the Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden course, we did a whole three-part series on that. The dialogue between the snake, if you remember the snake, the first story in all of Chumash, the very first snake, or first story I should say, the snake talks, it walks, it likes good food, and it's highly intelligent. And it's interested in women. Sounds pretty much like man. And I'm not saying that in a funny way. I mean, but if when you go through the first story, the snake is exactly like man. There's one man on earth, and the snake is very similar. Highly intelligent, it eats, sleeps, likes good food, walks upright. But the only difference, so what makes it a snake and man a man? If you were looking at these two creatures, so why is that a snake and that a human? What distinguishes them? So that whole course flow that we went through is the concept that the snake listens to its inner voice. The animal world, if you see it and it looks good to eat, eat it. And mankind says, but I was told not to. And in that concept, between what drives your behavior being, I don't know, I want it. And when an animal wants something, it does it. And none of us says, naughty shark, you're not supposed to eat people. There wasn't a choice. There was like, that's what animals do. And the human being also wants something, but was told by a being outside of it not to do it. And the human being has the ability to listen to the external voice over its internal voice. An animal only has an internal voice. Every time we listen to the internal voice that says, eat that donut, eat that donut. So that's being, if you'll excuse my vulgar language, being animalistic. It's just, there was an inner voice, there was a desire, so I did it. That other voice that says, you really don't need it. It's really not good for you. That's the higher self. That's the contrast. That's a simple example, which I feel very comfortable sharing because I had so far already two donuts and I'm waiting till the end of the class to have the other two. But that whole course that we spoke about of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden is this idea that distinguishes mankind from the animal world. Where does that voice come from? And it's only in areas of morality, which is why, by the way, eating donuts is questionable. That's only a moral question for the very highly attuned spiritual people who are very careful about everything that they eat, that they're not eating for their own pleasure, only to serve Hashem. That's where, we'll talk about more of this later, for most of us, that's like not even a moral question. Maybe it's a question about fitting into the outfit we want, but it's not a moral question. Free will is morality. Choosing between that which is right and that which is wrong. If you're going to eat a donut and you're trying to figure out if you want the chocolate covered with the custard inside or the apple cinnamon with the, that's not a free will choice. That's just what's your preference. I like this, I like that. If you're sitting there saying, I should eat it, don't eat it. That's a free will debate that you're watching. Which donuts you're going to take? Technical question. No free will involved at all in that. Now, the circumstances, this is the follow-up of that point is, the circumstances that we have in life will determine where our free will choices happen. Meaning our free will decisions are in areas of morality where we struggle between that which is right and that which is wrong. Well, all of us in this room will have different ordeals where we will have a clash between our understanding of that which is right and that which is wrong. and family circumstances and many circumstances in life dictate the differences as to where those decisions will be. As an example, Rabbi Akiva Tatz brings this following example. Let's say you take somebody who's raised on the streets of a really poverty-stricken community, and he knows nothing other than survival, and survival means mugging people and taking their money. That's what he knows. That's what he grows up with. That's what he sees. He doesn't know anything other than that. And for him, the decision to mug or not to mug is not a decision, because I never thought about that. Of course I'm going to mug somebody. There's a question that goes through his mind as he's mugging some poor frail woman. Should I exert excessive force or not? Or should I just take her pocketbook and run? That point where there's a sense on the one hand of that which is right and correct to do, and that which is excessive and unnecessary, is a point of a free will decision of should I do that which is right and that which is wrong. The fact that the area where I'm having this debate in my head is while I am mugging someone and stealing her money is irrelevant. That's not part of the free will decision for him, because that's not what his circumstances in life placed him. It's not what he was given. Within the world he grew up in, he has a decision to make. There could be someone else, I would imagine all of us, who would never even imagine being in such a situation. If any of us would have the thought to ever steal something from someone in such an overt way, just having the thought would already be a sign of a base, unrefined. I would never even think about that. Our decisions of where we have this conflict will be much more refined. Let's imagine if it's speaking Lashon Hara. We have a juicy piece of information about somebody and we know we really shouldn't share it, but it's really, really good. And we have an opportunity. It's like perfect timing. It would fit exactly the conversation we're having. And in our heads, like, don't say it. Oh, it'd be so great. Don't say it. Oh, come on. Just, that's the point of a free will battle. Totally different. Which one's more difficult? Which battle is more difficult? So Rabbi Akiva Tatz, based on a very important piece from Rabbi Eliyahu Dessler. Rabbi Eliyahu Dessler passed away in the 1950s. Really brought into modern, he wasn't studying psychology, but brought into modern psychological terms for our modern generation, these ideas of free will, expressed his idea very, very clearly in this regard. Whenever we have a moral debate in our heads, in which there is a decision to be made between that which we understand to be right and that which we understand to be wrong, that is the free will ordeal. How hard is that? Wherever you are, that's as hard as it gets. Where will that decision be? That's a moving target. Rav Dessler uses the example of a war. Today's wars are fought a little bit differently, but in not even so long ago, but let's imagine for the last 500 years, when there'd be a war, there'd be two armies at war, two countries at war, and there'd be a battle front. There'd be a literal line of battle. The old Civil War movies always depict this. Like, this is the field that's in between, and there's one side on this side of the field, and the other army on the other side, and then someone yells, and then everybody charges forward, and it's a bloodbath. That's how the war is fought. And then one side wins, and then they push, a couple hundred, whatever it is, maybe a couple miles to the side, and then there's a new battle front. Everything to the other side is now our territory, and now your territory is a little bit less. So Rav Dessler explains, on using that parable, that's how our life goes. We are in a constant battle of moral choices. Except there are some areas that are on one side. Let's say if this is our battle, the Shtender is the battle, and this is the side of good. I do those things without even thinking about them. I've already won those battles. I was raised in a way where keeping kosher, for example, I use myself as example. When I go to Kroger, keeping kosher is not a battle. I don't have a moral conflict every time I enter the supermarket. Like, this time, should I buy the kosher product? Should I? It's not something I think about. It's not part of my world. And I have parents and yeshivas to thank for that. It's simply not part of my world to buy something not kosher. It's not part of my children's world. I'm sure I've shared this joke many times before. of the, there was a woman at the checkout counter at a local supermarket, African-American woman, and, you know, as they're, you know, all the candy is right there. And so she has a little four-year-old child who says, I want a Kit Kat, I want a Fairy, I want the Hershey bar, over and over and over again. And finally she says, boy, it's not kosher. So there's a Jewish woman behind her who's looking at the scene, and the boy's looking all confused. And so she says to the Jewish woman, says, what do you mean, are you Jewish? What do you mean it's not kosher? And so the woman says to her, like, I don't know what it means, but I hear these Jewish women saying that in the supermarket all the time, and as soon as they say it, the kids stop complaining. Now, that's very true. It's just the world, you know, if a kid's saying, if they know it's kosher, then you got to come up with something better. But if they ask, can I buy this? You say, no, it's not kosher. My four-year-old already knows, like, oh, man, that's it. He puts it back and there's nothing to talk about. So someone growing up in that environment, when he goes shopping, it's not an ordeal for him. It's not a challenge. It's not a moral dilemma. That's already on the side of good. The battle's been won when it comes to kosher. And then there are areas on the other side, like watching every word that comes out of your mouth to make sure that it's appropriate, or every morsel of food that goes into your mouth, that it's what you need and not for your own personal... Wait. Who even thinks about those things? Like, there, you know, there's an ideal in Jewish life that everything a person does is for the sake of heaven, to be a better, God-fearing, God-serving Jew, and that would include... Every word that comes out of your mouth should be appropriate. Every morsel of food that goes in your mouth should be needed. Every minute of time is spent appropriately. Do you know that the Vilna Gaon, we studied the Vilna Gaon in our great Jewish books course, the Vilna Gaon used to come to Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur with a piece of paper with the minutes he wasted over the course of the year that he can klap an al chet, because he had several dozen minutes over the course of the year that had gotten wasted. That's on this side. We don't... who even thinks about that? It's not... I don't have a debate most of my life if I'm doing something which is not productive. It's not in my mind. Sometimes it gets so grossly unproductive that yes, but most of the time, not. So there's no battle. It's not that I'm losing the battle. I haven't engaged the battle yet. Well, where is the battle? Well, for each of us, that's going to be a different answer to that question. Where is that battle? But there is a point in our lives, and usually in different areas of our life, there are different points. You know, when it comes to behavior, there's one thing. When it comes to davening, there's another. When it comes to mitzvahs, when it comes to Shabbat, in each of these areas, there is a point where we fight with ourselves. Let's take Shabbat as a great example. I can ask you, are you Shabbat observant? So whatever you answer, you say yes. And whatever that means to you, yes. Now, believe me, to each one of us in this room, when you said yes, it meant something else. Because what it means to this person to be Shabbos observant means I eat a Friday night meal with my family. Anything else? Nothing else. So that's what that's my Shabbos. Great. And to this person, you know, you name it, they do everything in the book. And to each person and everyone in between, wherever they believe this is my Shabbos, that they do already. And then there's a whole series of things that they don't do. It doesn't enter their mind. And then each one of us has something that we know we should be doing better. We really don't like to do it, though. And that's a battle. And we know it. You all know it. I don't need to tell you what it is, because I don't know what it is for you. I know what it is for me, but I don't know what it is for you. That's the point of free will, right there. How hard is it for you? It's as hard for you as it is for me, even though whatever you're dealing with is not something that even enters my mind to do on Shabbos. And whatever I'm struggling with doesn't enter your mind to do on Shabbos. Maybe because you already do it, maybe because you haven't even started to think about it. It doesn't make a difference. Where the battle is, that's you. That's who you are. That's the you making the decisions in which no one else can dictate anything. Now, you can blame your parents for why your battle is there and not here. That you can do. You can blame your community for why it's here and not there. You can blame your teachers. You can blame lots of people for why it is that my battle is here and not somewhere else. But that's irrelevant, because the only thing that matters is wherever it is, you now have a pitched battle between the side of good and the side of evil, the side of life, the side of death. Choose life. Choose life, as Moshe says. And that's where it comes down to. Every step you take positively, well, guess what happens? as you move, in my example, this is a side of good, so as we move the spectrum this way, so guess what? This is the amazing thing. So you win whatever you're fighting about. Some of you will recognize, probably a lot of you, because I often find myself to be one of the younger people in here, and yet I can say, I've come to Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur with the same battles for like 20 years straight now. There are certain things that never go away. It's like you just don't move it, you don't budge it. And then there are others that you finally win. But guess what happens when you win a battle? There's no end. It doesn't ever end. The game never, ever, ever ends. The only thing that changes, and it's just as hard as the one that you just won. You're like, shouldn't there be like a victory parade, a confetti falling from the ceiling? Like, I did it. I did it. Now, some of you can say it was about keeping kosher. It could be keeping Shabbos. It could be wearing tzitzis. It could be davening. It could be putting on tefillin. Lots of things. And it's a fight. It's a fight. It's a fight. And then you have this moment of inspiration, and you do it. And then it becomes part of your routine. And then there's like something else, which is just as difficult. Because life is about that battle. That's it. Uvacharta b'chayim. Choose life, as you will always have a battle. You will never, as long as we are privileged to have breath in our nostrils, have a moment without a battle somewhere. It's only a matter of where and what we do with it. That is the fundamental principle. There's a Gemara that I like to quote. A passage in the Gemara, Maseches Nita. The Gemara says when a child is conceived, the newly conceived embryo is brought before a certain malach, a certain angel that's in charge of newly formed embryos, the Gemara says. Obviously, the Gemara doesn't mean that it's taken out of the womb. The Gemara is talking in terms of conceptually. And there's three questions that are posed to the heavenly courts about each embryo. It's a fascinating Gemara. The Gemara says, three things that are determined there on the spot. What will be with this unborn child? Any guesses that's what the three questions are? No, nope, nope. Gemara says, I'll give you a hint, I'll tell you one, you can probably get guess. Gemara says, will this child be rich or will the child be poor? Determined before the child's even born. Category number two?
Healthy or not?
A form of that, strong or weak. Okay. I would assume that would include, you know, a weakly person versus a very strong, healthy person. So category number three, any guesses? Nope. 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 Smart. Intelligent or not intelligent. What's the IQ? Three things the Gemara says. Wealthy, not wealthy. Smart, not so smart. Strong, not so strong. Those three things are determined. Now those are three very important things if you think about them. Those are the tools we're given in life. That's what the Gemara means when it says it's predetermined. You're given a tool. How much money will you have? Now, like anything in life, just like if you're given a field, but it won't produce anything if you don't do the work. You might be given a certain, just like, let's use IQ as the first one, because that's the easiest one. Here's your IQ. Well, what do you do with your IQ? Well, if you don't go to school, and you don't read, and you don't study, you might be really smart, but what are you going to do with that? You know, you need to develop it. It doesn't make a difference that you have a higher IQ than I do. You didn't read. You didn't learn. You didn't study. So your IQ is your potential. If you work hard, and you can work hard, and you can work hard, but you're going to be much smarter, because you were just given a higher IQ. That means if the Gemara says that's determined, that means it's a tool as to what are you going to do in life. What are you going to use your smarts for? But you just have a stronger tool. Same thing with money.
But somebody is dumb and they work hard also.
But they'll never, you know, just like that's, there are people who work really hard.
Right.
And they never, they don't have the certain
level, but not as much as the
correct
one, but
right.
It's still changing.
Oh, I'm going to give you a max. Like, what is the max level? And certain people have a lower IQ, and we all, you know, they can work as hard as they want, study as hard as they want, they just don't get it. So, okay, that's their tool. What does that mean? It means whatever they need to accomplish in life only requires that level. Same thing with wealth. We all know people who have worked like the exact same, done the same well in school, same background. Like, this one, everything they touch turns to gold, and this one can't, you know, just can't make ends meet. It just is. They didn't do anything wrong. They did everything the same. It just is. Some people are born into money. Some people marry into money. It just is. You look around and like, I don't know. These people have a lot of money. These people just don't. Guess what? Gemara says that was determined because those are the tools that you'll need. Same thing with physical strength, health, all of those things. What's not determined, the Gemara says? Tzaddik O Rasha. Will you be righteous or will you be wicked? That's not discussed in the heavenly court. Because in the heavenly court, they give each person the tools that they need to succeed. What they do with those tools, that's what life's about. What are you going to do with them? I gave you the tools. I gave you the money. I gave you the wealth. I gave you the health. And I gave you the intelligence. At whatever level we have all three of those, and everyone's got a different combination of them, that's what you need. What do you do with them? Totally up to you. This is also, by the way, encompassed in another passage from the Gemara, which is towards the end of your packet. I just want to show it to you. If you flip to the back. On page 11. It's actually towards the middle, I'm sorry. More towards the front than the back. Page 11. There's a passage in the Gemara, it's quoted on number 6, towards the top. The Gemara describes the impact of astrological phenomena at the moment of birth on a person's nature. A person who's born under the Ma'adim, one of the constellations, will be one who spills blood. That's what the Gemara says. All the stuff you find in the newspapers, what do they call those things? So now there's sort of silliness, but it's a real thing that's being played. It's a real concept. The Gemara talks about it, that depending on when, under what constellation you're born, what time of month, what time of year, it will make a difference on a person's personality. And the Gemara says there's a certain star that a person can be born under, Ma'adim, and he'll be a spiller of blood. So the Gemara says Rav Ashi, that means he might be a doctor, he might be a robber, he might be a shochet, or he might be a mohel. The fact that he has an inclination within his personality to spill blood, that's neither here nor there. That just means he has a certain inclination. What does he do with that inclination? Some people, you know, they could be a mohel. Many people are so queasy being in the same room as the bris, that it's just not for them. Fine, it's not for you. And other people, they're great at it. So maybe he was born in such a constellation, and he has a choice in life. That's his inclination. Okay, did you choose that inclination? No. Maybe, I don't know, he doesn't want to be. But that's his inclination. But now you have an inclination. What do you do with it, says the Gemara? You can be a murderer. You could be a shochet. You could be a moil. You could be a doctor. There are ways to cure people, to heal people, to fulfill mitzvahs, or to be destructive. The tool is given to you. What we do with that is indeed up to us. Every step we take improves our moral stature. Which leads me to the next question of why? Why is it set up this way, that there has to be this concept of free will as such a fundamental tenet? It has to be that we can make this choice in the area of these moral choices, and that is for the simple reason that every choice we make defines who we are. Tzaddik or Rasha, whether or not you're righteous or not, is not determined. That's up to us. And it's set up, life is set up in a way in which we constantly have to make that choice to define who we are, to become who we are. The choices we make are the people we become. There's this terrible thing that in life is, you meet somebody new and you say, like, what do you do? Who are you? Because I'm a doctor, I'm a lawyer, I'm an accountant, I'm a homemaker, whatever it is. That is such a non-Jewish response. It helps us to begin a conversation. But that, like, who are you? It has nothing to do with any of those things. Because when we get up to Shemaim after 120 years and they ask us, they call us by our Hebrew name and they say, Ploni ben Ploni, so-and-so, son or daughter of so-and-so, who are you? They don't want to know what you did for a living. Not interested. You want to know who you are, which is defined by the choices that you made. Where did you start making decisions? Where on that scale of 1 to 100 that I made up in the beginning, you know, where did life put you? What generation were you born into? What family were you born into? What city were you born into? What kind of education were you given? All of those things only tell you where your starting point is. And now I want to know who you are. So who you are will be determined on what you did with that. Which direction did it go and how far? Now, this is not to say, and I have to make a little disclaimer here, that there's not reward for mitzvahs that a person does. Let's say a person is a number 80, and he drops to a number 75. So he's doing lots of mitzvahs his whole life. He's keeping Shabbos, he's eating kosher, he's wearing tzitzis and tefillin, but he's just, it doesn't mean anything to him. There is credit, I am told, up in heaven, for all of those things. A person does a mitzvah, he gets schar, he gets reward. But there's a difference between the simple reward for doing the right thing and then the defining who you are characteristic. This is one of the pieces that Rav Dessler quoted earlier, talks about. You are the decisions that you make. There is always credit for doing the right thing, but who are you? Those decisions are the choices and the battles that you make becomes a part of it. There's what I do by rote because I was trained, and then there's who did I become. And who I became only starts from the point that you were given from all of the other factors in life that are thrown our way. Health and wealth and children, circumstances, those things are beyond our control. Only the things that are within our control is really where that begins. Okay. Let me share with you, page 11 I read. If you flip to page 17 for a second. Let's just read this one piece from the Ramchal. Moshe Chaim Lutz on the top of page 17. Yeah. After 11 goes 17. After 17 goes 5B. This is the new math. If you missed it in school, it's not too late. 11, 17, 5B. You got it? Part of the core, what do they call that now? The common core, yeah. I think that's how it goes. So the Ramchal Moshe Chaim Lutzer was one of the early Kabbalist deep Jewish philosophers. He writes as follows: as we have discussed, man is the creature created for the purpose of being drawn close to God. At the end of the day, why we are created, why we're here, why do we have to go through all of these ordeals is that we should succeed in them and draw close to God. He is placed between perfection and deficiency with the power to earn perfection. Meaning we are put in positions always between that which we can do to improve on the one hand and being deficient on the other. It's always that way. You will always find yourself in that. And so something, just resign yourself to it. There's never, we're like, ah, oh, I made it. Never. Does not exist. The greatest, most righteous, holy Jew ever, till his dying day, struggles, has an ordeal, because that's how God made us. We must earn this perfection through his own free will and desire. There's only one way to achieve perfection. There are no shortcuts. And the only way to do so is through our own free will and desire. If you were compelled to choose perfection, then he would actually not be its master. It can't be that you're forced to prove. You have to choose perfection. And God's purpose would not be fulfilled if it came to us naturally. It was therefore necessary that man be created with free will. This is the question we're discussing now. Why does it have to be this way? Why is man created with free will? Why is this deterministic approach so antithetical to everything Torah Judaism believes in? Because everything Torah Judaism believes in is man perfecting himself. Man coming closer to God. And the only way that man comes closer to God is by struggling and choosing so that it's yours and not anybody else's. When we, as Orthodox Jews, create a community and educate our children and try to give them the best, it's only so that when they struggle and make life their own, they're doing it in a much more refined way. Because we've put the bar so high up. We are not educating our children so that they don't have to struggle in life. We're not educating them so that they do things that it's easy. It's only so that the bar is all the way over here, and all those other traits, they're beyond that. They're going to really struggle on higher level issues. We're not changing the struggle. The struggle will always be there and will always be as difficult as for anybody else. Man's inclinations are therefore balanced between good and evil. And now, in order for this to be true, you always have to have a battle. In order for there to be a battle, whatever you are, whatever side opposed to you has to be equally powerful. And therefore, as we raise our level of morality, as we continue to choose good, the force within us, the desire to choose evil, exactly commensurate with where we are for the side of good, raises itself. The Gemara records a story that Abaye, the great sage, one of the Amoraim sages of the Talmud, was taking a stroll, and up ahead of him in the distance, he saw a young couple, not married, walking up ahead of him. And he recognized him, and he was fearful that something inappropriate would happen, so he dashed after them to protect them from anything happening. And he, puffing and puffing, runs ahead, and he sees them, and they're just sitting on a bench talking. And he comes back to his colleague out of breath, and he says, "I don't know, if that would have been me, I never would have been able to withstand that challenge." And the Gemara says on that, and says, "I know, that's true. Because you are so great, Abaye, your desire for evil is far greater than the average man on the street. And that which the average man on the street can handle, you actually couldn't. Because as your level of righteousness raises itself, exactly even with that, in order to keep this a battle, you have to have a more powerful desire for the side of bad to balance that out, so that you have to make a choice. And therefore, you look at others and you yourself say, I would never make it. And they don't have that problem because they're not on your level of righteousness, and therefore things aren't as, so to speak, desirous to them. They can manage themselves better. And you can't. And the Gemara presents a rule from this, called Hagodol Mechavero, anyone who's greater than his calling, Yitro Godol Mechavero, his desire for evil is also greater. And it's a moving, sliding scale. In order to always keep it balanced, that you sometimes will find yourself, if you're in a growth-oriented mode, as you're growing, you sometimes feel like, I don't know, I sometimes have a desire to do things that are either, I didn't even used to have this before, now it's even stronger than it was. Yeah, no, because you got new battles and stronger battles, and in order to keep it a battle, you literally sometimes will find that happening. And as he writes, the Rav Chal, Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzatzev, the second paragraph there, number one there, he has the power of choice and is able to choose either side knowingly and willingly, as well as the process, whichever one he wishes. Man was therefore created with both a Yetzer Tov and a Yetzer Hara, and he has the power to incline himself in whichever direction he desires. We as people are just, you just become more powerful. The more powerful you become, so then the tools you have are more powerful. So the two sides, in order for them to clash and create that battle, will also simply become more powerful as the battle rages on. Just to finish that thought, if on page 6, if you go, I assume from where I was, back to page 6, it goes 4, 3, 4, 6, the second page. Why is it that we have this battle? So just to finish the thought, so the Ramban writes in number 1, there in part B, number 1, that the reason why we have these battles is to actualize our potential. Meaning, that's why we're tested. All of these battles are constant tests we have in these areas of morality. And the concept is not because God doesn't know what our abilities are, but in order for us to actually actualize who we are, they have to be brought out. If you take a classic example, I'm sure we've discussed this in different forms. You know, an artist who decides not to paint isn't expressing who everything they I can paint, but if you don't, so then it's just latent inside of you and you haven't brought it out into the world. An athlete, a high-class athlete, world-class athlete, who's busy playing, you know, minor league baseball when they could be playing major league baseball. So, okay, you're tearing it up in the minor leagues, but big deal. It's only when you face competition that's equal to you will you actually express and bring out really what you're capable of. And that's why we're always, as human beings, we're always looking for a challenge that fits where we're up to. And if you're honest with ourselves, we get bored if we're not being challenged. Because being challenged is being who we are. It's developing ourselves. It's bringing ourselves out into a new realm. And so God does that to us all the time. In order to allow us to become who we need to become. And if you think back to our own personal challenges or challenges, you know, in other people around you, loved ones around you, it's hard to do this because the challenges are so painful sometimes. Really, really deeply painful. And I'm not in any way saying, and that's why people... But if you take out the question of why did it happen, you take that out because that's a different class, you know, suffering, we're not there yet. But if you just think of, well, what happened because of this, look at who they became, they never would have become that had they not gone through that. Did they? I'm not saying that's not why. I'm not answering that question. I'm just stating in hindsight. As human beings, they became something they never would have become had they not been pushed. Would they have asked to be pushed that way? Never. Painful experience. But they became a person who they never otherwise would have become. And each ordeal, each struggle we have in which we have the ability to become that is part of that process. Let me take the last few minutes and just address two very other important issues and last the letters on our outline.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So, is religious observance a moral issue?
Yes. Yes, in other words, morality from a Jewish Torah perspective would include two areas. One would be between man and man, and that's what the general world around us would also describe as morality issues, whether to be a nice person, an honest person, all of those things are that. And then from a Torah perspective, that issue would also include all of our religious aspects also, in which there's the side of us that says, I just don't want to do that, and that voice, like that snake, has where God says, I told you, you can't have that. And therefore, the morality issue is created not in the secular definition of morality, which applies to us as well, but from a religious perspective.
So would you call somebody to say you don't have to wear a kippah immoral?
Okay, so wearing a kippah is an interesting thing. I don't know if you meant that as a specific example.
It's just one example.
But in other words, but there's no mitzvah in the Torah to wear a kippah. There's I would put that in the world of free will, because in the world of free will, it's the choosing between that which is right and that which is wrong. As Jews, when we define right and wrong, we define right and wrong much more broadly than just a secular non-Jew. He enters the world of morality, but we also have all of our religious areas. So, like, keeping kosher is the decision between that which is right and wrong. Right and wrong is because the Torah says so, which the world around us might not think there's anything wrong with it, but we do. And therefore, it's a moral issue from a Torah perspective of keeping kosher or not keeping kosher, keeping Shabbos, not keeping kosher, wearing tzitzis, not wearing tzitzis. All of those are those same moral issues. And everything that I said applies. Some people get dressed in the morning, they put on tzitzis like it's putting on socks. They don't even think about it. That's beyond the battle. Some people don't even own a pair of tzitzis. They're not thinking about it. That's also beyond the battle. And then there are others who, and same thing with Shabbos and all those things. But all of those, I'm glad you're clarifying this for me, all religious areas as a Torah Jew fit into that morality discussion, the choice between that which is right and that which is wrong. And we're all on various aspects of the spectrum. Some of us are where we battle, where we've already lost, and where we've already won. Is that clear? Did I answer that? Yeah.
But you do have to add to that the knowledge involved.
Yeah, 100%. In other words, someone who doesn't know anything about it, right, would obviously be in the area where it's not even part of his world. He's not even not debating it. He's not fighting it. It's beyond his battle point. And any of those who do it by rote, you know, I use it as an example about myself all the time in terms of wearing tzitzis. It's just part of my routine. If you would even ask me, like, after I get dressed, did you put on tzitzis this morning? I was like, I don't know. I guess I did, because I always do, but it wasn't anything I thought about. So there's credit for wearing tzitzis, but there's no credit for winning a battle. And when I was in fourth grade, I had a battle with that. That I remember very clearly. But not anymore. That's already, that battle's been fought and won, and now it's part of the routine. It's by rote. You know, my battle now is, do you stop and think about what you're doing? But it's not a battle of, do you do it? 100%. Yeah?
If you're two Jews, the one who is religious, be a real monster. That's not a terrible answer.
Yeah, whatever, yeah.
A bad person.
Yeah.
And the one that knows nothing could really be kind, does chesed.
100%, right.
So, who's that?
No, so you're asking a different question than I started with. That's a different complex question of what happens if I have the Jew who I defined as a 75 or 80 on my spectrum, but in his interpersonal relationships is a 3, and you have a person who's a 25 in his spiritual spectrum, but he's 100 when it comes to interpersonal relationships. Great question. I have no idea what the answer to that question is. That's one of those questions that's a great philosophical debate, because we don't need to answer that question, because there's no practical difference to that question. Usually, debates are good when they result in should we behave like this or should we behave like that. That's a real powerful debate. That question, there's no, I don't know, you still need to do the right thing always, whether or not this guy's better or that guy. The answer to that isn't, oh, therefore I don't need to do anything religious, I only need to be a good person. You need to do both. Everybody agrees you need to do both. So which one's better is a totally philosophical debate that has no bearing on, like the question I asked in the beginning, but yours is like that also. Okay, two more. Let me get to two more points, and then we'll tie back to where we started, and then get more donuts. So letters E and F, there are two very important questions that have to be addressed in any free will course, which I'm going to share them, but not really address them because I can't. Number one are, doesn't God know everything already? This is a very fundamental question. You talk about free will, which means that we have the ability to choose. Every time we have an ordeal, we have this inner debate between that which we know is right and that which we know is wrong, and we're trying to choose the right thing. Doesn't God already know what we're going to choose? Doesn't He know everything already? Hayahu ve'viyah, He was, He is, He will be. It's all happening in front of Him at the same time. So how can I have free will to make the choice that God already knows I'm going to make? If He knows I'm going to make it, then I can't be making free will. He knew that I was going to make this choice. It's a simple and complex at the same time philosophical question. So I just have two things to say. Number one is I don't have to answer that question because the Rambam was a much smarter person than I, and I have no problem admitting to that. And he couldn't answer that question. So since he couldn't answer that question, so I don't have to answer that question. If you want to just take a look at his language in 5b, there are two courses. Remember these curriculum. So there were two courses on free will: free will 1 and free will 2. So from the free will 2, I didn't want to put number 5. That would have been a really confusing math if my page numbers went 4, 5, 11, 17, 5. So I put 5b because they were from the second set. As you see on the top of the page, free will too, if you want to go look them up online afterwards. Anyway, the Rambam number 2 on page 5b writes as follows. This question discussing how can it be that we have free will if God indeed knows everything? Know that the answer to this question is longer than the earth and wider than the sea. That's a common phrase the Gemara uses when it means to say like it's really, really deep. It's longer than the earth and wider than the sea. A human being is not able to understand this issue completely, just as he is unable to perceive the true nature of God. What it means to say is as follows. The answer to that question is, well, first you need to understand what it means to be Hayaho Veviyah, to be past, present, and future all at the same time. So if you could only understand that concept, then you'd understand how it is that God can know what you're going to do and you still have free will. Oh, you're a human being. You can't understand what it means to be in the past, present, and future at the same time? Sorry. So you're going to get stuck on this question. That's what he means to say. We're by definition limited. The condition of being human limits the ability to understand the answer to that question because the answer to that question is rooted in being above time. In other words, we live through time linearly. We live the moment that we're in right now, which happened after the moment prior and before the moment next, and we live life that way always. And we can't go backwards, and we can't go forwards. And so we're limited by time. That's the human condition. It's just the way that it is. We've always been fascinated by the idea of going back to the future, or back to the past, into the future, whatever movie you want to go with. That's a fascination we have, because wouldn't it be so cool to be able to do that? So it is, and it would be, but it's beyond the realm of the human being. But it's not for God. The answer to this question is rooted in that idea. So we don't have an answer for that. But for whatever it's worth, I've always enjoyed the following parable that somebody has told me. Imagine a movie that you've seen before. And then you watch it again, and then you watch it a third time, and a fourth time. And you really, to the point where you like, you know it, backwards and forward. So as you're watching it, so you know what's happened really clearly because you remember it because you've seen it a whole bunch of times, and you know what's going to happen. But meanwhile, as it's happening in front of you, the scene that's playing out, again, it's just a movie, but imagine what, like, let's say they're trying to depict real life, or better yet, it's a home film, like you've watched, you know, kids or some basketball game that you taped from a kid in high school or something. When that was taking place, the person who made whatever decision that you're watching, they made whatever choices they made. You're watching it with the knowledge of everything that's going to, you've seen it. You know what's going to happen, what's going to play out. But the person who you're watching now, they had the ability, even though I know what they're going to do, that's because I've seen it all. But they, when they went through it, had the but that's not real life. But to God, that's sort of the closest parable I've ever come up with of actually being able to, like, you know, you could, like, fast forward, you can rewind, you see the whole thing. even though for us living through it, we have our freedom. But the bottom line is I don't have to answer that question. I have to acknowledge it. It is the question that's asked when it comes to free will. And Maimonides and others have said the problem is we're so, it's part of the human condition to be too finite to really be able to understand that answer. So I'm not going to get into it too much. It's just the unfortunate reality of life. There are a number of limitations to free will, which are well rooted in Jewish thought. And as much as it's a fundamental tenet, there are limitations to that. Very, very briefly. Number one, rulers, meaning people who are in charge of entire countries. The verse in Mishlei in Proverbs says, Lev malachim biyad Hashem, the hearts of kings are in the hand of God. And as the Shlomo Melech in Sefer Mishlei in the book of Proverbs means to say, when you're running a country and there are millions of people under you, so your decisions impact so much that God has a way of often, so to speak, taking away the free will of the individual ruler because big things have to happen. And since this one person is in control of big things, you will often find that that's what takes place. That they'll make decisions, and the Talmud will say on that, that was an example of Lev Malachim Biyad Hashem. A classic example is, the Gemara talks about the sage Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who snuck out of the siege of Jerusalem before the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash, and he had an audience with the Roman Caesar at the time, and he prophesied to the Roman Caesar that he was going to become the Caesar. And as he's standing there, messengers come running in from Rome that the current Caesar had died, and they had appointed this particular army officer as the next Caesar. So the Caesar, the newly appointed Caesar, was so impressed with Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, he says, ask me for three things, your wish is my command, I'll grant you the three things. And he's standing outside of Jerusalem, he had snuck out of the walls, siege is there, and he asks for three things. He asks for a particular sage to get a doctor, who is not well. He asks for the sages of Jerusalem to be able to move to Yavne and to reestablish their academies. And I forgot what the third thing was. And the Gemara asks, why didn't he ask for the siege to be lifted and not to destroy Yerushalayim? He could have asked for anything. The Gemara brings two answers. The Gemara says a concept called tafasta meruba lo tafasta. There's an English phrase called you can bite up more than you can chew. The Gemara says if you grab hold of a little bit, you'll get it. If you try to grab hold of too much, you end up with nothing. That's Gemara's first answer. The reason why he didn't ask for all of Yerushalayim is because he was afraid if he asked for that, he would get nothing. So he asked for smaller things. The second answer the Gemara gives, Lev Malachim Biyad Hashem. Because God took away his ability to think straight. Because God had a plan for Yerushalayim to be destroyed, and the fact that he had the ability to ask for three things, it didn't occur to him to say so, because his ability to come up with them was taken away. And you find that, the sages use that in other instances, based on the verse in Proverbs. There are times when a person, a particular place of leadership, no political comments here on any of our current leadership, but there are times where things are done and you say, what? And the sages would say, yeah, that's because the decisions, the world is moving in a certain direction and God is pulling strings and things have to happen. That's one place where you find it from the sages where free will is limited. There's another situation of punishment for sin. The most famous of this, of course, is Paro. Whereas the punishment for his sin is hard, was hardened in order to go through all of his punishments, where a certain ability of free will is actually removed. And there's a third, more very significant time, which is the Messianic era. Sages say very clearly, this is the very last source that you have, I believe, on page 17, it's the last source of the first series of sources, actually. No, I'm sorry, that's the wrong one. My pages got mixed up, I'm sorry. It's on page 13b and 14b, the last two pages. In the Messianic era, free will be removed. Why will free will be removed in the Messianic era? Because this idea of ordeal, of a clash between that which is right and that which is wrong, is removed. Because God's presence will be so openly revealed that there no longer will be a struggle between that which is right and that which is wrong. It's all going to be obvious. It'll be as obvious as all of us have the ability to put our hands in a fire right now, and we don't. And the reason why we don't do that, assuming we're mentally stable, is because, why would you do that? It's so obvious that you're just going to harm yourself. You don't put your hand in fire, you're just going to burn yourself. So the spiritual world will be as clear to us that you can damage yourself. You can hurt yourself and gain no benefit from it. There's no longer free will. Free will will actually be suspended. And the Ramchal, I quoted this, one of our earliest Kabbalist thinkers, expresses, because at the end of the day, the purpose of the world is the revelation of God's presence in the world and the oneness and unity of God, which we spoke about in the first week. The way that the world is set up is that that oneness and His presence in the world will be revealed through human beings making choices in life to reveal it. Every choice we make, every ordeal we have, when we choose life over death, when we choose right and moral from wrong and immoral, is revealing God's presence in the world, because look, I heard that voice. I'm not an animal. I'm not the snake. I heard a voice and God's presence is revealed. I could be in a room by myself. But when I behave in a way because of that voice that tells me what's right versus what's wrong, I've revealed His presence in the world. That's how the world is set up right now. But there'll come a time when we will get there where it will be fully revealed. And then the method will change. Right now it's set up where through our free will is His will revealed. Through our choices is His oneness brought into existence in this world. But when it will be fully expressed in the Messianic era, then it will not be through our free will, because that will actually have been removed because of that element, that openness, that His presence is there. We won't have free will, which is a fascinating philosophical concept, which we're going to leave for now. This idea that that which is the fundamental tenet of everything we do, every moment of our life is about struggle, choices, becoming who we are, and then in the end game, when we get there, then it's removed because the presence, the unity of God will be so clear that we won't have that. Yeah? Oh, thank you. So back to the two Jews. So we take the Jew who's now at a 75 but who began at an 80, or the Jew who's at a 25 but he began at a 20. So what do you say now at the end of the class? So the 25, this is why these are good philosophical debates that have no practical outcome but are interesting discussions. When it comes to defining who you are, the primary essence, the 25 Jew is in a much better place because he has created himself. He has taken what he was given in life and through his decisions and his choices has raised the bar, and therefore he is a much more developed soul than the first Jew. But as I mentioned, a Jew gets reward for everything that he does right, whether he's doing it by rote, whether he's doing it because he was trained that way. And at the end of the day, the Jew who's a 75, at the end of the day, knows a lot more Torah, has kept a lot more mitzvahs. How that plays out in heaven, it's been taught to us that the nature of those two rewards are different. The reward for earning it and making it is much greater. The reward for doing things, just because it's by rote, without thought, it's there, but it's less. So I don't know the answer to the question as to how does it stack up. You know, a lifetime of 75, a lifetime of Shabbos and Kashrus and Sittus and Tefillin, even though there was no thought and you really weren't 80, now you're 75, I don't know how that weighs versus the Jew who raised himself 5. I know that it's an interesting debate because it's weighted more when you create it yourself. You take what you're given and you push the bar forward. I don't have an answer to the question, but this is why it's a good philosophical debate, and it has no practical outcome because we all need to be moving upward every day of our life anyway. So whichever one is better doesn't change the fact that that's the direction we need to be going in, and that's the all good philosophical questions don't have an answer. Yeah, last question and I'll let you go.
If you don't live up to your potential, are you immoral?
If you don't live up to your potential, are you immoral? If you mean to say by that the reason why I didn't live up to my potential is because I was making immoral decisions, so I would never want to define someone as immoral. Because for the same reason as I said before, no, let's say my choices are, you know, whether or not I'm going to waste 2 minutes a day or 4 minutes a day, because I'm on such a level where the rest of my day is being spent in religious endeavors, so I would have made a couple of bad choices every day by wasting an extra 2 minutes, but I don't think anybody would define me as immoral, even though where my battles are, I lost them, I lost today, but for me, losing the battle meant wasting 2 minutes. So in my moral choice, I lost, I didn't live up to my potential, but I don't think anybody would call me immoral. Because, you know, the way that we use that, I did everything right. I watched a YouTube video.
Minor league, but you could be in the major league.
Right, so but that doesn't make me immoral. So in other words, if I watch a video that has no value and I waste 3 minutes, so I made an immoral choice. And from a Torah perspective, that choice to spend those 3 minutes watching the video was an immoral choice. I might not be in a place where I'm making those decisions. I'll watch plenty of videos without thinking about it. But it was an immoral choice because I could have done something productive with my life or unproductive. And now that it's unproductive, I'll never get those minutes back and I will not fulfill my potential. That's a true statement. Every time I watch a meaningless video, my potential goes down because what I could have fulfilled in life isn't. So it was an immoral choice. Am I an immoral person for watching, you know, some video? I hope not. But I made an immoral choice, and my potential will not be reached because those 3 minutes of my life are gone, and what I could have accomplished, I didn't. Okay, so, you know. All right, ladies and gentlemen, enjoy your break next week. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.